I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Call me Snake.
With blackest eyes, the devil's eyes. Purely and simply evil.
You're out of your
mind, Wayne.
God bless you.
What do we do?
Hello out there and welcome back to Precinct 13, the podcast about all things John Carpenter. My name's Nick Rocco Scalia. My co-host is Chris Oliphant. Hey, Chris, you got a smoke?
I do, but I'm not going to share it with you.
In case that ham-handed reference wasn't evidence enough, tonight we are talking about Assault on Precinct 13, the second film by John Carpenter, the first one where he basically gets sole writer-director credit. So as you were saying on our previous episode, this is kind of the beginning of his real sort of solo filmography.
Yes, indeed. And this is written, directed, composed, and edited by the man himself. Am I right?
Are you saying that John T. Chance is not a real person?
I love that. I love that so much. So I can't appreciate the reference fully because I've never seen Rio Bravo. But yeah, so he used, looks like Carpenter went under the pen name John T. Chance in the editing as a... It's just giving props to Rio Bravo, right?
Yeah, and it's a way of kind of acknowledging the influence without, like, hiding from the influence, which I think a lot of filmmakers who are maybe less honest, less upfront than John Carpenter might do, but he just puts it right out there. Before we get to the conversation about Assault on Precinct 13, though, in case anyone is joining us for the first time, this is our second episode, but Chris, do you mind reminding our listeners what we do here on this show?
No, not at all. It's a pretty straightforward podcast. The goal here is to cover all of John Carpenter's feature films in chronological order. So Nick and I will be going over every last one of his films. And then in addition to that, we'll be discussing some of his musical efforts as well, some of his albums and some of the scores that he's composed. But the basic artery of the show is just to cover John Carpenter from Dark Star all the way to 2010's The Ward.
I really like that you use the word artery because we have a lot of blood to talk about tonight. This is a very, very violent movie that we're going to discuss, and I'm looking forward to doing that. Before we get to that, though, I figured since the show is going to cover, like you said, the expanse of John Carpenter's career, we left off last time with his first film, Dark Star, which he started making as a film student at USC, and I thought we'd just catch up a little bit as far as what he did between Dark Star and what became his second film, 1976's Assault on Precinct 13.
Sure.
So as we said last episode, if you haven't heard that one yet, it is available everywhere fine podcasts are sold right now. So if you got some catching up to do, we will wait for you. But at the end of Dark Star, once that film got distributed and released, there was some acrimony between him and his close collaborator Dan O'Bannon, and those two guys split up. They had originally had plans to make a number of additional movies together. They were going to swap off directorial duties, and that was going to be like a real serious tag team partnership in the filmmaking world that never really materialized. So John Carpenter, after Dark Star, is kind of all by himself at this point.
Right. Yes, and him and O'Bannon had quite a fallout. I read some of his comments about this movie in particular that I found striking. But anyhow.
You mean O'Bannon? Yeah. O'Bannon's comments about this movie?
Yes. Yeah.
Uh-oh, we will have to talk about that later because I don't know that I've seen that. And I can understand how he might not be the biggest fan of Assault on Precinct 13 and how maybe Carpenter wouldn't be the biggest Alien fan. But they did both sort of go their separate ways. The marriage didn't really work out. And... Luckily enough for both of them, this is still a time in Hollywood where this young talent can really get a foot in the door. So what Carpenter ends up doing is writing a couple of scripts, is basically continuing to develop stories. And one of them turned out to eventually be Assault on Precinct 13. The other one was a script of his called Eyes that eventually got made into a movie called Eyes of Laura Mars in 1978. Chris, have you seen Eyes of Laura Mars?
I am not, but I must say I am intrigued. And I think that didn't get made till, wasn't that, didn't that come out in the 80s? Or was that, I'm not sure when that one came out. No, I have not seen it, but I'm very curious.
Yeah, it's 1978, so... If he wrote these two at the same time, then it took a little bit longer to actually get to the screen than Assault on Precinct 13 did. Basically, what happened was he wrote that as a treatment. It got seen by Jack Harris, who was the producer who eventually agreed to distribute Dark Star. And Harris had a copy of this treatment and showed it to John Peters, who's a huge, huge Hollywood producer, worked on Superman. I know him as one of the producers of Caddyshack because I've watched like all the behind-the-scenes material in Caddyshack. That's one of my favorite film comedies of all time. So this guy's a high roller in Hollywood, sees this script, is willing to buy it, wants to turn it into a star vehicle for Barbara Streisand. I believe him and Barbara Streisand were dating or married at the time. But what ends up happening is this script gets out of John Carpenter's hands, kind of ends up in the studio, I guess, meat grinder, if you want to call it that. I know Carpenter was not pleased with the changes that they decided to make to it, and it ends up being heavily rewritten and comes out a few years later, starring Faye Dunaway instead of Barbara Streisand, and directed by Irvin Kershner, who 2 years after this goes on to make Empire Strikes Back, which is a movie that people like a lot.
Wow. I feel like we definitely have to do an episode on The Eyes of Laura Mars. It has enough significance to it in Carpenter's story where I think we should at least do a mini episode on it or something.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth a look, especially if we can get a copy of, I mean, sometimes you can find these things, sometimes you can't, but if we could see what his original screenplay or at least his original treatment looked like and then compare that to the movie that actually got released.
That'd be interesting.
Yeah, I think it would be just sort of an interesting way of getting into that film and taking a look at where Carpenter's head was at this time. I thought you were going to say, let's do an episode on Empire Strikes Back, which I would do because I'm a huge Star Wars fan and I agree with most people that that is the best Star Wars movie. But that's really going down a rabbit hole there. That's really going off on a tangent. So before we do that, before I start talking about Bespin, the Cloud City or anything like that, just to come back to John Carpenter this time. So he's got these two screenplays. One of them goes off and ends up in the studio system and gets out of Carpenter's hands. And the other one, which does have some higher budget ideas in it, but can be done on a more modest scale, he brings to another USC alumnus, a friend of his from college named J. Stein Kaplan, who is a producer. Kaplan brings it to another producer friend of his, Joseph Kaufman, and they basically put together a very, very small budget. I mean, Assault and Precinct 13 is made for $100,000, which was a little more in the mid-70s than it is now, but was still not really a budget that you could make a really quality feature film on, unless you're an incredibly talented young filmmaker, which John Carpenter was. So he kind of has a few formative experiences there, right? Like he loses a script. I mean, I think the intention was for him to go on to direct that script, Eyes. And I mean, again, if we actually see the film that got made, I'm pretty sure anything made by somebody like Irvin Kershner is not going to look much like a John Carpenter film. So again, there's like these what
ifs. Probably not.
Yeah. Like his career is full of these what ifs. Like, if he and O'Bannon had stayed together, if he had gotten to direct the script that obviously was a passion project. I mean, he is this sort of ambitious young screenwriter and director right after getting his first feature released at a very, very young age. So I think he probably had some really fascinating ideas for it that we never got to see. But he has that experience, which, you know, I guess happens to a lot of young filmmakers. But also he gets this chance to make the low-budget film that he wanted to make and pay homage to some of his heroes. And that's where we arrive at Assault on Precinct 13. So still a pretty young guy at this point and still just looking for his footing in the industry. And with this film that became very successful, is just about to find it.
Yeah, and this, so his script ended up being titled The Anderson Alamo, and is basically influenced by Rio Bravo, the Howard Hawks film, which I have not seen, and George Romero's Night of the Living Dead, which I have seen.
sure you had seen Night of the Living Dead. I wasn't sure about Rio Bravo.
Oh, yeah. What a cool combination of two movies to be inspired by. And yeah, that being said, let's get into John Carpenter's assault on Precinct 13.
On Saturday, six members of the gang known as Street Thunder were ambushed by the police. On Sunday,
Cholo,
the warlords of Street Thunder swore a blood oath to avenge their dead. For the gang called Street Thunder, it is a day of vengeance. It's war in the streets.
Oh, Jesus, come on. Come on, I'll give you my money. Just don't hurt me. Please. Please.
It's terror in the night. It's the most shattering assault on a police station in history. Assault on Precinct 13.
This is a siege.
It's a goddamn siege.
All right, we are back, ready to talk about Assault on Precinct 13. Chris, I spoke to you about this not too long ago, and I told you I was going to do this on the show. I'm going to put you on the spot for a second here.
Okay.
What I would like to do is have you tell me, what is Assault on Precinct 13 about? Like, what is this entire movie? What happens in this film? And I want you to take no more than 30 seconds to tell me everything I need to know about Assault on Precinct 13. Are you up to the challenge?
I can do that. I think I can do it. Okay, I'll just go. So it takes place in South Central Los Angeles. There is a local gang that basically they've stolen a bunch of weaponry. They're driving around looking to kill people. They kill a few people. One of those people gets revenge, kills one of them, and then escapes to this like decommissioned precinct. And in that precinct, we have some of our other main characters that are basically just there because they were assigned to be there, and a busload of other people that get brought there, and they're just stuck in this precinct while they're getting invaded by these gang lords like the entire movie. Is that pretty on point? I mean, I think, I don't know, just kind of rambling there, but that was all off the top of the dome.
No, that was pretty good. Yeah, it's a pretty simple concept. It's a very sort of direct, stark, very easy to talk about movie because it is exactly what you said. It's a street gang raids a derelict police precinct that's about to shut down, and the few people that are left there, and some criminals and corrections people that arrive there, they band together to fight off this gang that has, like you said, all these stolen automatic weapons, all of which have silencers on them, so the gunshots
yes.
don't get heard outside the neighborhood. So basically very much like Rio Bravo, which is a siege movie. It's a Western that is set in a sort of isolated location like this, where there is an attack coming in from outside, much like Night of the Living Dead, right? Which mostly takes place in like a farmhouse where
yes.
zombies are busting in through the windows and everything like that. And it's about this group of survivors banding together to just sort of fight off this kind of faceless horde that's coming in from outside. And I think one of the things I really like about this movie is that that is what it is. I mean, it's not going for any sort of larger thematic point than just sort of the survivors versus the gang. It's not trying to sort of be any more epic than what it is. I mean, it's an isolated story about isolated people. And it really doesn't take us out of this enclosed location for much of the movie. And I think that's one of the things that's really effective about it. Not only because that makes it easier to shoot this on a very, very small budget, as we were saying, $100,000, which even then didn't go particularly far, but also I think there's a real claustrophobia and a real paranoia that John Carpenter's able to generate in this movie because we never really leave this location. And it is a very, very limited location. It's just a small place and vulnerable. And, you know, it almost feels like the walls are closing in throughout, Mostly the second half of this movie. I mean, I would say there's a whole lot of setup here, and we'll talk a little bit about that. And it's a lot of setup for again, what I would call a pretty simple story, but I think there's some things about that that make it really effective, too.
Yeah, I remember reading somewhere, I think John Carpenter wanted to call this The Siege at one point, and it was the studio that kind of convinced him to go with the Assault on Precinct 13 title. But yeah, I mean, this movie starts off with a scene that we get some pretty brutal violence right off the bat, right? We got these gang members kind of creeping around in this alleyway, and then they just get blasted with shotguns like by the police right off the bat.
Yeah, it's really an effective start for this movie. I mean, it's handheld camera. It's really, really gritty. I mean, you can tell, like, it's shot in Panavision, which is this really nice sort of widescreen format. You can make a real epic in Panavision, like a Western, like something set in the wide open spaces. But there's no real wide open spaces in this movie, right? Like, it's all these sort of enclosed locales. And yeah, this opening scene, it's just a handheld camera following these gang members, basically down an alleyway, it's a corridor, but it looks like an alleyway because it's open on top. And there's two police officers with shotguns, like looking down on them from the rooftop. And we never see the cops' faces, but we just see them just blasting over and over and over with these shotguns and just like bloodshed everywhere. And, you know, one of the first things I said to you about this movie, and I'll say it again, I love 1970s movie blood. There's something about the way blood in these movies looks. It's like very dark red. It's very thick. It's not very realistic looking, but there's just something very cool. Like, it reminds me of like a Dario Argento film or something like that, where, you know, it's not so much about the realism of it, but just the color, the sort of visceral effect of like that thick red stuff just like getting sprayed all over the screen or just sort of dripping everywhere.
Yeah,
there's something that just really works for me on kind of a visceral level with that. And yeah, I mean, I think we learn right away that this is going to be a very brutal movie. You know, we get like half a dozen plus people mowed down with shotguns, like in the most graphic way possible, like right in the first 30 seconds of this film. So I think that was, like, from what I understand, that scene was shot later on, that was shot after they had completed principal photography, and they just needed a prologue. They needed like almost like a cold open, a little gag to start things off. And I think that was a good idea. I mean, I think it sets the tone really nicely. And think about if you're seeing this in a drive-in, like in the mid-70s, like if this is meant to be an exploitation movie, you get that exploitation scene right up front. And you know that this is not going to be a classy prestige picture. This is going to be a down and dirty rock'em sock'em violent ass movie.
Yeah, I mean, these cops just blast the crap out of these guys. And basically, you know, so that establishes that, because I don't even know why the cops would say stop or freeze or anything. I mean, they literally just snipe these guys.
Oh, they are shoot first and then, don't bother asking questions. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it's great because we get the scene. You were just talking about how much you love your 70s blood. I never really thought of blood from like an era perspective. So that's interesting. But like, it's cool because now we see the gang lords and they're in this room and there's the blood in the bowl scene where they're all like, you know, cutting themselves and bleeding into this into this vase or something. I don't know.
Yeah, they're like taking a blood oath. Again, these are things that he's basically borrowed from the Western genre, where Native American tribes would do things like that to like swear revenge on their enemies or something. I mean,
yes.
It's all kind of, it's a little silly, I would say. I mean, if you want to watch a movie that is a realistic portrayal of gang warfare in Los Angeles in the 70s, this is probably not your movie. They do not behave like, I mean, look, I've never been in a street gang before, so I don't know. Maybe they do stuff like this all the time, but I would assume that this is probably not the most realistic portrait, but it does make them these sort of very cold, very inhuman killers. And in that scene where they're taking this blood oath, we get to meet, I think, one of the creepiest characters in the entire John Carpenter filmography,
which Frank is Doubleday.
Frank Doubleday, yeah, who also acts in Escape from New York and developed a good good working relationship with John Carpenter, and right away, so he's the white guy who is basically just like cutting into his arm with a knife in this scene and seems to not feel any pain whatsoever. He's got this very intense face. He kind of reminds me of Michael Shannon, actually, who is one of my favorite actors and has this similar quality of just being totally menacing at all times, even when he's maybe not trying to be. And
Carpenter says on the commentary, on the Blu-ray commentary that I listened to, that he wanted Doubleday to just act like he's a machine. Like, he doesn't have any feeling. He's just like this. He's basically like a killing robot, you know?
Yeah, he's a pre-Terminator Terminator almost.
Yes.
I actually wouldn't have minded seeing him play a role like that later on in like an 80s Terminator ripoff.
I would not either. A couple other, just to describe some of these other gang dudes, what's up with this guy that looks just like Che Guevara?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I said this film didn't have any real political subtext, but maybe it does.
I think it may have more than you're maybe giving it credit for, but one of these guys looks exactly like Che Guevara. I mean, from the facial hair to the ethnicity to the beret, I mean, it's hilarious.
Well, one thing that I think is kind of funny about these, I mean, this movie is played pretty much dead serious until a little bit later on, but so we get, just before this, I believe it is, there's some exterior shots, and we get a news report, and there's a like a police commissioner, and he's being interviewed about this gang that, I don't think they ever call them Street Thunder in the movie, but in stuff I've read afterward, they're supposedly called Street Thunder, which is
interesting,
pretty hilarious name. But this guy actually makes the point to say that they're like a very ethnically diverse gang. Like I forget exactly what the line is, but he makes that point. And
he makes it a point.
Yeah. And I think that's more to sort of cover John Carpenter's ass. Like, he casts like all these people that probably wouldn't be in a gang together as this gang.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
And they all have sort of a different look, like they don't have exactly gang colors or anything like that. And I think that's probably because he didn't have a lot of money for extras. So, you know, one thing I definitely did hear was the gang members in the original, that scene we just talked about, that prologue, they were all basically film students that he had come out and portray gang members in this little opening sequence that he shot.
Milking those USC connections again.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the reason why this gang is the way it is, I mean, partially is just because he couldn't cast like a bunch of people that looked like they actually were in a gang together. So he just sort of throws together this mishmash of different looking actors. And because they all sort of act the same way and they're all really bloodthirsty and really relentless, we just accept the fact that they are indeed a gang called Street Thunder.
Yeah, right, which I believe you are correct. I don't think Street Thunder is ever actually mentioned in the movie itself, but...
No, because it's a really stupid name.
Yeah. So we got to talk about, I mean, whenever I think of Assault on Precinct 13, I think of, like, the two main characters. We have two, in my opinion, very powerful performances here from Austin Stoker, who plays Lieutenant Bishop, and Darwin Jostin, who is Napoleon, who is the criminal. Before this thought slips my mind, there's a few other... We mentioned the John T. Chance pseudonym earlier. There's a couple of other games that are being played here with names. Did you pick up on any of those? Like, for example... we have Nancy Keys is playing Julie as Nancy Loomis.
Yes.
Okay, so that ends up becoming Dr. Loomis in the Halloween movies. And then also Laurie Zimmer. I cannot remember. So Laurie Zimmer is playing a character named Lee.
Yes.
And I feel like I read somewhere that had something to do with Rio Bravo as well. Is that right?
I'm not sure about that, but it's interesting that you have an actress named Laurie in this film and a character named Loomis in this film, because we know what comes next in the filmography, or somewhat next in the filmography. So, yeah, I mean, you can sort of see where some of those ideas came from here.
Right, and then we also get have to point out Charles Cyphers, because he ends up being in, like, a bunch of John Carpenter movies, who plays Starker.
Yeah, he's kind of a fun character here. We don't get to know him really well, but he's really good in the scenes that he's in. I want to go back to something you were just saying, because I think it's really important. So,
okay,
Assault and Precinct 13 is kind of a buddy movie in some ways. I mean, like we said, it's about this isolated group of survivors or survivalists, almost, that are trapped in this police precinct, and this gang is crashing down the walls and coming in through the windows and coming through the basement and everything like that. And the two sort of major characters that emerge are like polar opposites, right? You've got this very straight-laced cop in Bishop, and you've got, I mean, I don't know exactly what to say about Napoleon. He is a killer of some kind. He's some kind of real badass criminal. We never know his backstory, and I think that's one of the really fascinating things about the film. But it's like these two guys from opposite sides of the law throughout the movie, they get closer and closer and sort of overcome their differences and learn to work together and learn that they actually really complement each other really well. And so to me, I mean, maybe this is a little bit of a stretch, but I sort of feel like this movie in some ways anticipates the buddy cop movies that come out in the 80s, like a decade later, when you got films like Lethal Weapon, where these sort of opposites, these opposite partners team up to fight crime. You almost see a little bit of that here. And I love the interplay between these two.
I think you nailed it right on the head. I mean, isn't that really, if we were to, you know, do a thorough analysis of like what the reading in between the lines of this movie, it's about kind of coming together despite our differences against adversity, or, you know, being like in a warfare type situation where it's a survival scenario. And Napoleon, yeah, you're right. He's a mysterious character. I love Darwin Jocen's acting job in this is awesome.
Yeah, he was John Carpenter's neighbor at the time. They just lived in the same building, and Carpenter just kind of saw something in this guy that was like, yeah, he could totally play this very John Wayne-like hero. I wanted to mention, the reason why I bring up John Wayne there is the shot where we first meet Napoleon is in a jail cell, and is it Straker?
Starker, I think.
Starker goes in to basically retrieve him from his cell, and there's this camera movement there that I think is a very, very specific homage to something in an earlier film. So I don't know if you've seen Stagecoach, the John Ford ensemble western from the 30s.
I have seen like nothing of this era or of that era or genre. It's horrible.
Well, I highly recommend Stagecoach. Quentin Tarantino really likes that movie also. It's a big influence on The Hateful Eight. We've been talking about The Hateful Eight, I feel like, a lot on the show. But anyway, John Wayne in that film, this is before John Wayne is a huge star. So he's just part of the ensemble. He's an important character in Stagecoach, but not the most important. And before we meet him in that film, all we know is he's this very charismatic young outlaw character. And there's a shot, so the stagecoach sort of pulls up to where this guy is standing on a bluff. It's this beautiful exterior cinematography that we get here. I mean, there's great scenery in that film, like a lot of John Ford films. But the camera movement that introduces us to John Wayne's character, he's called the Ringo Kid, is this really fast-paced dolly in. So the camera like pushes right up to his face, from a little bit farther away, and he's holding up a rifle, and he's just giving you this sort of very strong look to camera. You can see he's got that very heroic chin and everything like that. And I think when writing about that film a while ago, I think I described the camera movement as breathless. Like, the camera just dollies in on him so quickly that it actually goes out of focus for a split second there, because they just really want to get this rush of movement to show this character. And we know right off the bat in that film that this is going to be a really important character. It's someone that we're going to just want to keep an eye on, and we think he's going to be the hero of the movie, even though he's been talked about in these sort of outlaw terms, but we don't know that yet. He could kind of go either way. He might become like the big bad villain in the movie. And I think we get basically a direct homage to that shot when we meet Napoleon in Assault and Precinct 13. So you get this very fast push in on him. He's sort of doing the same thing. He's looking right into the camera. It's this very sort of confident look. And we learn right away that this is a character that we're going to need to pay attention to, because he is going to be important later on. I will say, one thing about this movie that I really like about it is that you never really can tell who's going to live and who's going to die. Like, it's not telegraphed from the beginning. Like, if he had gotten popped off like a half hour into it, I'd be like, well, yeah, I guess so. I could see that happening.
Well, the deaths are very sudden in this movie. I mean, we get a whole handful of fatalities within a, you know, 5 seconds of the movie. And, yeah, I was wondering that when it gets towards the end and, you know, the gang's coming through the windows and they're all just bucking shots everywhere. I was like, dude, what is the body count in this movie? At one point, they're like, oh, there's got to be at least a dozen bodies out there. And I was thinking to myself, man, I feel like I saw more people get killed than that.
Yeah, that's a very low estimate. It's a very conservative estimate of how many people actually died outside that police precinct in this movie. I mean, it is. They are, like you were saying, I mean, much like Night of the Living Dead, it is this faceless horde, and they just kind of keep coming. And, you know, we'll talk about the siege sequence. I mean, it takes place about, I guess, maybe 2/3 of the way or so through the movie. And it's just this orgy of wanton violence that happens. I mean, we sort of see it coming, but I don't think we realize, even up to that point. I mean, this movie's been brutal up to that point, but literally you've got like almost 5-6 minutes of screen time where it's just like people popping up and getting like gruesomely blown away.
Yeah. And I mean, the mechanics of the story up until that point are all pretty simple. I mean, you can break down, like, you know, Lieutenant Bishop, for example, again, played by Austin Stoker. He is like, it's like his first day on the job, and he's looking for, you know, he gets in his car and he's looking for an assignment. And for whatever reason, you know, he gets assigned to go to this decommissioned precinct. And he, right off the bat, he's just kind of like, well, why am I even going there? There's nothing for me to do there except stare at, you know, empty boxes or crates or whatever it is he says. And they're like, yeah, well, nonetheless, there's that line where the guy he's reporting to is like, so you want to be a hero your first night on the force? And he's like, yes, sir, I do. and the guy's just like, yeah, there's no heroes anymore or something like that. It's kind of a dark, sort of interesting, like, pessimistic comment to make right there. But
yeah, he's a little bit of a goody-goody, this character. Like, Bishop is, yeah, he's that, like, you know, just fresh-faced cop, and he really wants to do good. He really wants to fight crime and make an impression in this law enforcement world. And it's a real insult to him that he's basically given this do-nothing assignment. And it really does seem like nothing is going to happen. And I like that. I mean, Carpenter himself, so I was listening to one of his commentaries on this, and he basically says he would have liked the pace to be a little bit faster in the first half of this movie, because for a long stretch of screen time, it's a lot of setup, not a lot happens, and we get this sort of almost like laconic mood out of it, where he's just meeting the people in the precinct. There's some gang members, they're just driving around. I mean, we don't really know where any of this is going. We get the father and daughter, they're just like looking for an address.
I mean, let's be real here. I mean, by today's standards of an action movie, this thing moves at a snail's pace. I mean, it's really slow.
Well, until it gets going. I mean, it does get going.
Until it gets going. The first, but I'm going to say that, to be fair, the first maybe 40% of this movie is pretty slow and just getting everything established. And then, yeah, once all hell breaks loose, it's pretty much nonstop from there. But yeah, so he goes to this precinct. They're basically about to close the place down. They're to the point where, you know, by the time that day is over, they're going to have, like, no communications in this place. The phones, electricity, things of that nature. And he's just supposed to, like, stand around and watch the place. And that's when we're introduced to Laurie Zimmer and also Nancy Keyes' character. And they just play, like, what? They're just, like secretaries or something at this precinct, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're one's a dispatcher. I think one of is like some kind of administrative assistant. They're not cops, or they're not, you know,
right
cops.
Yeah. And there's a few different plots going on simultaneously. So, like, while that's going on with Lieutenant Bishop's character, we're also meeting the scene we talked about before, where we get introduced to Napoleon. He's getting on a bus with a bunch of other criminals to be taken somewhere else, which is like hours and hours and hours away, wherever it is they're actually headed to. I'm not sure.
Yeah, see, I wish I knew California geography a little bit better, because they're using names like Sonora and like there's a scene in Las Cruces, which I know that's a place in California, but I have no idea where that is, like, in relation to Los Angeles. So they end up in Los Angeles, but, like, yeah, it's this really, really long prison bus ride. It's the like It's mentioned somewhere that they're on death row, but you never really get an impression that they're about to be executed, like that's right. What they're traveling to.
Yeah, and right. And just to tie it all together, I mean, because all of these people end up in the same place, and I think the movie does kind of bring all of this together pretty well, but the other plot that's going on is with the guy, I can't think of his name in the movie, but he's played by Martin West, and he's driving around in the car with his daughter, and he's lost, basically. They're trying to get to his mother's house to take care of her. They're lost, something like that. So we've got the criminals on the bus. We got this guy driving around with his daughter, and we have Lieutenant Bishop going to the abandoned precinct. Like, all three of those plots are sort of happening at the same time, and we get these on the screen. It'll say the location and the time. And then the other thing going on is, like I said before, you got the gang just sort of joyriding around town as they assemble their... Oh, my God. That is one of my favorite scenes in this movie, is when they don't say a single word, and they're just in the car putting the silencers on their weapons.
Yeah.
For, like, a full-on minute.
I like that you use the phrase joyriding, because there is no joy in that car at all. Like, they're all just, like, expressionless. They're just these stone-cold motherfuckers, and...
Yeah, that's so,
like,
true.
You look at them for a half a second, and you can tell that these guys are just up to no good, and they just do not care about anything.
Yeah, and it's great. You got Carpenter's, like, synthesizer in the background with the, like, hi-hats going and everything, and, like, these guys have zero dialogue and zero emotion, and the camera's just going right through the front windshield of the car, and they are just putting together their guns, and you hear all the clicking and snapping and popping. It's great.
I mean, I do think it's a very effective setup. Like I was saying, Carpenter basically, you know, in viewing the film in later years, one of the comments he had about it was, I wish I had sped this up a little bit, and I wish I had kind of gotten the pacing nailed down a little bit better. But I actually really like the slow pace in the first half of this film. I mean, I think it really sets us up for something. And I think just at the point where we start to get a little bit bored, as you said, that's when all hell breaks loose. But I think this movie establishes a whole lot of atmosphere. There's a lot of intrigue there. We certainly know with these characters that something very bad is going to happen with them. I mean, we should talk about the ice cream truck sequence. And
you read my mind.
Everything leading up to that is very slow and deliberate and drawn out. And they sort of, like, the way those characters encounter this ice cream man and this father and daughter team, like, it's just done so slowly and done so deliberately that we know something is going to happen, and he draws out that tension right until there's just this moment where something's got to give, and when it does, it's just even more shocking because of the way it's sort of led into so slowly and so just very, very carefully and methodically, I feel like.
Yeah, this is where the controversy in the movie lied, because our boy Frank Doubleday shoots the little girl, and it's like a bloody shot, and it is rather shocking. I can only imagine how shocking it was before the desensitization that we've gotten in 2019.
Well,
like,
I can't think of many movies that aren't, like, just straight up trauma movies, like complete exploitation movies that are trying for shock value. I can't think of many scenes in other movies where a little kid just gets blown away like that. And I've seen this movie a few times. This was my first time in probably about 15 or so years. And I did not remember there was blood in that shot. Like, the way when I thought back to that scene, I remembered him pointing the gun, and you get a reaction shot of the girl, you get the reverse shot of him shooting, and I thought there was a cut there. There's a cut back to her where there's a splatter of blood and she falls out of frame, and that is pretty brutal. I mean, this movie was given an X rating, and I really like this story, actually. So, you know, Carpenter is like, well, should we cut that scene so the MPAA will be okay with it? And basically what the producers told him was, no, just send them a version where that's cut out, and then distribute this to the theaters, like, uncut the way it was. So I love when people work around the system like that. But I mean, I don't think that scene has lost an ounce of shock value. I mean, I think maybe in the world that we live in today, it's it's not the greatest thing to see something like that, you know, a kid being shot in a film that is otherwise just an entertainment movie. I mean, like we said, this is not a prestige pick. This is not an awards contender. So to go that step, I mean, I think it looks different to an audience now than it would have then. But either way, no matter sort of where you're at as far as movie violence goes, this is just a really shocking moment of movie violence. Tells you everything you need to know about this character, certainly. Frank Doubleday's gang leader, member, whatever he is.
Yeah, a heart of stone. And it is effective, too, because you get enough time with this character, Kim Richards, who plays Kathy, the young girl there. Like, she's adorable, you know what I mean? She's this like sweet little girl, and
yeah, I like her. All she wanted was an ice cream cone.
That's all she wanted was an ice cream cone, and she gets blasted away. Then we have Frank Doubleday's character, you know, taking the nozzle of his gun and just shoving it down the ice cream man's throat.
Oh, I want to talk about that, actually, because there's a little thing in that scene that just unnerves me to no end, and I think it's a great moment of performance. Oh. Before he sticks the gun in that guy's mouth, he just, like, slowly sticks two fingers into his mouth and, like, pulls his jaw down and then slowly slides the gun in, and something about that is just so beyond creepy. Like, you know, if you've seen enough like action movies and cops and robbers kind of like crime dramas, you've definitely seen somebody have a gun stuck in their mouth before, but I've never seen it done quite like that. Like this thing with the fingers, there's like something.
It's just, like, so personal.
Yeah, it's like weirdly intimate. Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. So that just makes him even creepier than he already is. And you know, again, thinking back on that scene, I didn't remember that the ice cream man gets killed too, but they just do not leave any stone unturned when it comes to witnesses and potential people to wipe out.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say the creepiest part about that scene is how Martin West's character has to get out of the car and go into a phone booth to call someone and ask for directions.
Yeah, well, it's a relic of its time, right?
Yeah, so
we haven't had a good phone booth scene in a movie in so many years.
Yeah, and this is where it gets crazy, right? Because now we have the father obviously sees that the young girl's dead. He gets pissed off, gets the gun from the ice cream man's truck, who is kind enough to point out that there was a gun in there before he takes
his
final
last breaths, right? Like his dying moment. He's like, oh, by the way, there's a gun right under the dashboard in my ice cream truck.
Yeah, exactly.
Avenge me.
And this dude just hops in his car and peels rubber and, follows down these gang lords so that he can get his vengeance, which he sort of does. I mean, he ends up killing Doubleday's character there, who killed his daughter, and then for some unknown reason decides to run instead of get back into his car. But that's how he ends up at this precinct, is because after he kills one of the gang members, now they're all after him, and he's running and running and running, and then he finally ends up at this precinct where Lieutenant Bishop is watching. So that's how they meet. And by the way, I'd like to point out, and I thought this was a little bit odd, but the father, this character played by Martin West, he becomes a mute for the rest of the movie. Like, he is in a state of catatonic shock or something after killing someone and after seeing his daughter get murdered. He doesn't have a word of dialogue for the rest of this movie.
No, and, like, I didn't remember that either. Like, I thought he would actually join up with them at some point and help them fight off the gang invasion, but he doesn't. And I kind of have to wonder, and you know, I'm sure you can find this out somewhere. Like, I wonder if it's just because they didn't have that actor for the certain days of shooting where they were doing these big action sequences. So it's like, all right, we'll just have him. I mean, I've made some low-budget, like, student films and stuff like that before, and one of the things you have to do is sometimes find workarounds like that, where it's like, okay, let's find a way where this guy does not have to be in this scene, I think this actor Martin West, he'd been in like a bunch of Western TV shows, like, you know, almost like DiCaprio's character in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, right? Like, he kind of had this journeyman B-movie TV sort of film career. So he was kind of sort of one of the big names in this cast, and maybe they just didn't have the money to pay him, or just maybe scheduling wise, they couldn't have him in all those scenes. So yeah, he's just sort of cowering on the floor when a lot of this stuff is happening and everyone's like, what is this guy doing here? I have a question though, and maybe you can answer it for me, because I feel like this movie has two setups. One is these gang members are killed by the police, and therefore this gang really hates the police, so they want to kill cops, right? The other setup is what you just said, where this one particular guy kills a gang member, and then the gang is coming after him, and he happens to end up at a police station. So, like, which one is actually the setup of the movie? Because I don't necessarily think you need both, but it's got both.
It does, and the, both those things absolutely are happening simultaneously. I think for the gang members, it's kind of like the best of both worlds, right?
They're like, kill two birds and a bunch of people with one stone, yeah.
Yeah, they're like, you couldn't have ran into a more ideal place for us to just go in there and start, you know, causing mayhem and destruction. So...
I also kind of have to wonder what Street Thunder is all about, right? Like, as a gang, they don't seem to do much besides killing people, and there's not a lot of money in just murdering people, right? Like, do they sell drugs? Like, what is their, what's their end game here? I guess I have to wonder.
I don't know. That thought never occurred to me. Back to Martin West, though, when he pops up again towards the end of the movie, I remember thinking, this guy's still alive?
Like, yes.
I forgot he was even in this movie. I mean, I thought he would have surely been one of the casualties that went down in the one of the several blazes of glory that happened in this movie.
Yeah, and there's so many bullets flying around. How does he not get hit by one? Like, everybody else is jumping over desks and, like, hiding behind walls and stuff like that, and he just kind of is in the same place the whole time.
Yeah, he's just wrapped up in a blanket or something.
Yeah, I guess that's supposed to be. One more comment about him, actually, because there's a quick shot. It's not even really a scene, but there's a shot that I wanted to talk about. While he's on the run from the gang members before he gets to the police station, he runs into a phone booth and there's this gang member chasing him. He's behind him. And I got a real serious Halloween vibe from that scene.
Oh, because, yeah. I already knew you were going to say that.
Yeah, like the way that stage, like one of the things I love about Halloween, and we'll be talking about that movie in the weeks to come. But, like, John Carpenter, I guess, establishes very early on here that he's not really a jump scare guy. He, to create horror, to create suspense in his films, what he does is sort of put the bad guy, the killer, in the shot with the victim. And rather than have him just sort of pop up out of nowhere, we get him establishing the space and we can see him getting closer and closer and closer. And that's one of the reasons why I think Halloween is still such a scary movie, is because, you know, we're not just waiting for a silly jump scare, but we are seeing the predator and the prey sort of interacting and you know, just narrowly avoiding, like we're seeing this character just narrowly avoiding this person who's just coming after him and is relentless and is not letting up. So I think there's, you know, I mean, this is not a horror movie, but it is, it has moments of horror. It has,
oh, it's suspenseful.
Yeah, it's definitely suspenseful. And there's horror techniques and horror tropes that are being used here that I think get really sort of taken to the nth degree in Carpenter's next feature film. But yeah, I just wanted to mention that shot because I think it's just a really effective shot. And again, by this point in the movie, we've had a lot of setup. But now, like, my heart's racing already and we haven't even got to the real action of the film yet.
Yeah, and... one last leg that we should tie into how everybody ends up in this precinct is, so Napoleon's character, while he's on the bus with the rest of these prisoners to be taken off to death row or wherever the heck it is they're being escorted to, there's this guy who's just like coughing all over everything and coughing all over everybody to the point where it's like a legitimate concern medically. Like, they need to get this guy somewhere where he can be evaluated by a doctor. And it just so happens that the closest place that they can stop is at this precinct. So when Starker's character, you know, makes the executive decision to stop there, he convinces Lieutenant Bishop to at least get the prisoners out of the bus and into a cell so that they can seek medical attention for this guy who's coughing all over the place.
Yeah, it's really gross. Like,
it is.
I found those scenes a little bit hard to watch because that guy really does seem like he has something contagious, like, and he's so convincing, like you almost feel like you can get it through the screen.
Right. So you've got, you know, Bishop is there because he was assigned to be there. And then you have Lawson is there because he was running away from the gang members after killing one of them. And Napoleon is there because he was brought on a bus full of criminals, including another major actor in this movie, and I can't think of what his name is now, but I'm going to look it up here.
That's Wells. Tony Burton as Wells. I really like this character, by the way. He's
I do too.
You know, he doesn't get as much screen time as some of the other ones, but he has real presence. Like, this guy is, I just sort of happened to look him up because I enjoyed him so much in this movie. And he appeared in the Rocky franchise and did have a career after Precinct 13. So, you know, this was sort of a launching pad for him. And I can sort of see why. I mean, he's like, I don't know. I almost want to call him like a gentle giant kind of character.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's always he's cursed with bad luck, I guess. But thing I wanted to point out here is that did you see the trailer for Three from Hell?
I have not, but Austin Stoker, I've heard, is in Three from Hell.
Well, you just took the words right out of my mouth. Like, the trailer starts with Austin Stoker playing a newscaster, and when I was watching the trailer, I was like, oh my God, is that the guy from Assault on Precinct 13? And sure enough, it is. Yeah, so where were we? We were talking about Tony Burton and his character. Yeah, he's absolutely a pivotal character and one of the few survivors in this movie as well. And another strong performance from him. I think all of the performances in this movie are pretty damn good for a group of actors that there's really nobody like famous in this movie. Some of them had acting experience, but I thought there were good performances across the board.
I enjoy the acting in this movie. I think a lot of the dialogue is very clunky. You know, this definitely feels like, I don't want to call it amateurish, because I think some of the writing is really solid in this movie, but just some of the one-liners and the back and forth and the banter doesn't really work. Like when Bishop in the beginning is he's getting coffee and one of the female characters says to him, "Black," and he says something like, "Last time I checked," or something stupid like that.
No, he says "my whole life."
My whole life. That's what it was. You know, there's a little bit of that. There's a little bit of that sort of clunky, you know, attempting to be comedic kind of dialogue here. But I think one thing that does work is there are these little things like Napoleon always asking for a cigarette.
Love it.
Which is just a fun little bit there. And we'll talk about my favorite scene in the movie a little bit later on, but we should probably talk about the siege, because once things really do start to go down in this film, as we were saying earlier, you get this sequence that is just like pure, raw, visceral action where these characters are fighting for their lives, using what little guns and ammunition they have to fight off this just like onslaught. And Napoleon gets broken out of the cell. He breaks a guy's arm. We get a bunch of criminals sort of coming in through the basement past the cells, and he gets the drop on one guy, and there's this really great shot where he breaks the guy's arm where it really does look like somebody got their arm broken there. Like
He snaps that arm backwards so hard.
Very
man.
Effectively choreographed, like a lot of the action here. I mean, it is like, I really like the way this movie is shot and that sort of very closed in kind of claustrophobic feel of it, because none of the fighting in this movie feels like staged movie fighting. Like, it looks like people are actually getting hurt here. And, you know, when someone gets shot in this movie, they usually like fall back a little bit. Like, it's not like they're doing that stylized sort of, like the in a Western where a guy like holds on to his heart and slowly falls out of frame. But this is just like really quick flashes of just out and out brutality. And, you know, they do use a lot of squibs. Like, there is a lot of blood here. There's a whole lot of broken glass in this movie. And in this scene is where it really just, it escalates. And, you know, the movie does have an action climax, but this is the big action set piece in the movie where you've got the most characters alive inside the precinct and just sort of the most opposition coming in from the outside. So they just like basically barricade all the entrances, and these gang members are coming in from everywhere they can possibly come in from, and all the characters have to split up, and they all have a role to play in the scene, which I think is just good writing, just a solid choreographing of an action scene where everybody kind of gets their moments here.
I agree wholeheartedly, and I should say one important element here is, so one of the cops goes outside and he gets sniped like right away. And I can't forget if it's Nancy Keyes' character or Laurie's character, but they're like, oh, he fell over, you know, and yeah. And that's that's when Bishop goes outside and he gets fired at and realizes immediately that the other police officer was shot and killed. And that's an important element in this movie, is that he has to explain to them they're using silencers. So the silencer aspect of this is important because that's where the movie is given the dramatic license to be able to say, all right, they're going to be firing all kinds of ammunition into this building, but since they're using silencers, no one around can hear it. And it's such a sparsely populated, like, section of the town that even the fire that the police are returning back with their limited ammunition won't be able to be pinpointed by anyone that lives there to say, hey, something's going on here. So the gang is smart enough to cut off the phone lines and cut off the electricity pretty much right off the bat.
And hide the bodies, which, you know, I don't know that they would actually be able to do that. Like you mentioned that before. I mean, these are sort of dramatic conventions just so you can have this like remote fortress in the middle of nowhere. Like in a Western, that would just be out in the middle of the desert or something, like in Rio Bravo. But here, you know, they do have to sort of massage things a little bit. Like they do have to just add in these little conventions so that you'll believe that this police precinct is as remote as it is and is as cut off from the rest of the world as it is. And, you know, I think once the tension starts to ratchet up in this movie, we stop thinking about that stuff. Like it no longer becomes important to, I mean, you know, we're not looking at this as any kind of realistic portrayal of police on gang violence, I guess.
No. And I mean, I want to talk about the scene you were just talking about, because once the gang really opens fire on this building, and it's weird because when they're looking out the windows at first, they're like, oh, there's no one there. And then there's these scenes where it shows these, you know, groups of people just kind of like creepily running around behind the bushes outside and stuff like that. And it's like, oh no, like there's a whole group of people out there. When they start firing on this building, there must be 5 minutes of just shot after shot of glass shattering and bullets ricocheting off things. And it just keeps going and going and going, almost to the point of hilarity. And I love it. Like, I almost want to watch that scene with all the windows shattering and the bullets flying through, and then just like rewind it and watch it again and just admire at how much fun they probably had. Because, again, working on such a low budget, those were probably achievements that they were so proud of, right? Like having it look like they're realistically being shot up and stuff.
Oh,
like
yeah.
That.
And they destroy that set. I mean, it is, you know, like a sort of trope you see in a lot of low budget movies is, you know, you try to make it look like there's a lot of mayhem and violence happening, but you can't really like get any stuff on the rug and you can't really make holes in the wall and stuff like that. You know, I've shot stuff like that where it's like, all right, well, we can maybe put a bullet hole in like through, you know, I mean, back then it would have been like a post-processing thing, like a double exposure kind of thing. So you could make it look like there's bullet holes on the wall. Now you could just like go in After Effects and CGI some bullet holes in, which looks terrible most of the time, but a lot of low budget movies do that. But this is very obviously, I mean, they completely trashed that set. And, you know, through the sound design, through the really quick editing you get there, I mean, it is, like you said, it's violent and full of mayhem, almost to the point of hilarity. But the note that I took about that scene is this scene moves so fast and is so violent and brutal that I couldn't stop it to take notes. Like, I was just so sucked into it. Like, I wanted to sort of, like, you know, comment on the camera angles and stuff like that. And my only comment is that I just get so drawn into this action that's happening and how quick it is and how quickly we lose a couple of major characters here and stuff like that, that there's really, you know, you don't want to pause the movie at that point. Like, this sequence deserves to be seen in and of itself, just sort of all by itself.
Yeah, all very good points. And I think it's interesting to point out, like, looking back, I mean, this movie has been reevaluated by critics and audiences since its release. I mean, it's Do you know that? Do you know what this movie is on Rotten Tomatoes? Do you have any idea? Have you looked at it?
I've got to imagine it's high.
Yeah, it's like freaking 98% or something like that. And I find that so interesting because a lot of these low budget movies, like, I'm sure you must have read into like the box office reception of this movie when it came out. Like, No, it had a very weak release in the United States and didn't get very good reviews. And then it was released in Europe at this film festival. I can't remember if it was Great Britain or France, one of the two. I apologize for not knowing, but it was like a sensation over there. And that's when it started to get some buzz and some momentum. And then this movie ended up being reevaluated and hailed by critics and fans alike as like one of the best action movies of the 70s and one of John Carpenter's best films. And I always find that so wild that things can come out and be duds at first and then not just be reevaluated and be like, oh yeah, it's a pretty solid movie, but being reevaluated as like a complete classic.
Yeah, I mean, that's the definition of a cult classic, right? Like something that sort of gains that stature over time. And, you know, I think a lot of those movies, I mean, some of them are just for pure shock value, right? Like, oh, did you see this thing from the 70s where this crazy thing happened? But I actually don't think that's why Precinct 13 ended up with that status. I think it's just because it's really well made. I mean, it's not a perfect movie. And I could see how audiences maybe seeing it for the first time might be sort of stultified and bored by that first, like you said, like something like 40 minutes where very little happens. And then you get that scene of totally brutal violence against the little girl. And I could see some people walking out of the theater at that point. But once you actually get into this movie and you see these really well choreographed action scenes and stuff like that, and, you know, Carpenter becomes a household name after things like Halloween and Escape from New York. And so people want to see his earlier work. And it's much harder to do back then, obviously, than it is now. But I do think, you know, part of the reason why this movie has endured is just because there are things about it that are just so, so good.
Yeah. And the chemistry between Napoleon and Bishop is great in this. It's obvious that Napoleon respects Bishop, you know, because he respects him. So they end up actually becoming quite a force, the two of them together against this gang that's just basically coming through the walls of this place. But we do, as you said, I'm sorry, I got a little off track there, but back to what you were saying, we lose a lot of characters in a really short period of time here. We lose Starker, and we eventually lose
Julie.
She also gets killed. So, you know, basically it comes down to these four characters are the only survivors left, and they have to come up with a plan. One scene that I have to bring up is, so police eventually do get dispatched to come check on, you know, disturbances in the area or whatever. Do you know what scene I'm about to bring up, Nick?
I hope it's 1 potato, 2 potato, 3 potato, 4.
Oh, no, I was going to talk about how when the police come by the precinct, there's nothing there. There's nothing going on. They're like, okay, whatever, because this gang's been doing such an incredible job at getting rid of the bodies and the evidence somehow. But there's one scene where the police car stops and they hear something like rain or dripping on the car. And they realize that there's blood falling on the hood of the vehicle, and they get out of the car and they look up, and there's a dude like just hanging from like a power line or something like that.
Yes, another horror moment and a really weird one. Like, I don't really understand how that guy got there.
Yeah. Neither do I, but that is a odd and bizarre sort of scene that I guess is just in there to even further show us the brutality of these gang people or something.
Yeah, like they're not just going to kill you. They are going to hang you from a light post. That scene reminded me a little bit of Die Hard, right? Where Al Powell goes up to Nakatomi Plaza and, you know, he gets dispatched there and he's like, oh, there's nothing going on here. And it's not till he's backing out when Bruce Willis drops a body on the hood of his car that he realizes that stuff actually is happening at Nakatomi Plaza. So right, it's like right. These movie cops that don't really want to investigate much further than what's right in front of their faces. You know, maybe this is pointing the way toward that also. We have to talk about the potato scene because I completely forgot about that. This movie is played mostly with a straight face. I mean, there's some one-liners here and there, and Napoleon certainly, and he's a witty character. Like, he is good for a few laughs here and there, and the cigarette thing, it's sort of a running gag through the movie. But this movie takes a really strange turn into comedy that I absolutely love when Napoleon and Wells, they are trying to figure out which one of them is going to sort of go through the sewer and come out in the back parking lot of the police station. There's a car there, and it's this plan that's probably not going to work. Someone's supposed to go out there and get the car and not somehow get shot by this gang that's all around them and has like thousands of guns or whatever, but whatever, they come up with this plan. It's not a terrific plan, and because they think it's likely going to be a suicide mission, they have to figure out who's gonna go. So instead of drawing straws or anything like that, very seriously, someone says potato. I believe it's Napoleon. So, you know, with sort of no humor in his voice whatsoever, he says potatoes, and they agree to it. And we get this two shot where these two guys, Wells and Napoleon, they come at each other from opposite sides of the screen, like it's going to be this epic confrontation, and they play one potato, two potato, three potato, four. And in this movie that has just been chock full of violence and is kind of very serious in that it kills off a lot of major characters, and we are meant to take the deaths pretty seriously, like we're meant to sort of be sad that that a character like Julie dies, and you know that these characters that we are meant to like and sort of get to know a little bit get wiped out in this film. And then you get this scene that brings just a smile to my face just thinking about it, where these two stone cold badasses, you know, these killers, these these criminals, they come together and they play this little kids game to decide which one of them is going to go out and attempt this mission. And I just love that scene so much. Like, Carpenter frames it in such an austere and serious way, like it's you know, like it's the final showdown in this epic movie. And that's what the showdown actually is one potato, two potato.
I love that. You can also detect some chemistry going on between Napoleon and Lee here, too.
Yeah.
They've got some sparks flying there, I think, a little bit, you know, which doesn't really get developed on too much. But there is a little bit of that in here. And
well, it's interesting with Napoleon, right? Like, we've seen movies where these kinds of characters all end up together. And one thing that you kind of expect to happen is that we're going to have a moment later on with Napoleon where he's going to, like, turn on his allies, where he's going to maybe point a gun at Bishop or something like that and reveal his true colors, that he actually is a bad guy. And then maybe it turns out he isn't. Like, there'd be, like, a little surprise, like a reversal there. And there never is, right? Like, once we learn that he's on their side, he's just on their side. And, you know, like you said, you think there's going to be some sort of consummation of this little sexual tension that's happening between him and Lee. And there isn't, you know, it just becomes sort of strictly platonic, and they've got bigger fish to fry than whatever budding romance they might have going on. And
she also, there's also a cue there too, because she's the one who finally is able to provide him with a cigarette. So when he asks her for the smoke, she actually has one.
Yeah. And that's all he wants in the world, right?
Yeah. So basically, I did want to mention one thing about, this is going to be a stretch, but I'm just going to go for it. So Nancy Keys plays Nancy Loomis, right?
Nick? Yes.
Okay.
No,
I thought I lost you there.
Nancy Keys plays Julie. So Nancy Keys, whose real name I believe is Nancy Loomis, plays Julie.
Got it. See, that was confusing me the whole time. So her name in the movie is Julie. Nancy Keys is how she's credited, but her name's really Nancy Loomis. Is that what it is?
I believe she's credited as Nancy Loomis, but her real name is Nancy. I'm not even sure how you pronounce it. It's K-Y-E-S. So it might be Keys, Kies, something like that.
Kies. Okay. Either way, there's a scene in this, because her character doesn't really have too much to do in this movie. We are going to see her again in Halloween, and I think she's in The Fog, too, actually. There's a scene in this movie where it shows kind of human nature at its worst, where when they realize that they're trapped, and the fear starts to set in, she looks over at Martin West's character, and she makes this suggestion to Bishop and Lori, hey, they just want this guy here. You know, like, why don't we just give this guy to them and they'll leave us alone? And that's where we get to see Bishop's, like, you know, integrity as a police officer, and how he genuinely, everyone's safety is in his best interests, and he's not going to let that happen. Besides, you know, he knows better. The gang members, even if they gave up this guy to the gang members, they just kill them all anyway.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know what that reminded me of? That reminded me of a scene from that movie, The Mist, where that crazy religious lady is, like, pinning everything on the guy who plays the soldier, and they want to, like, sacrifice him to the crazy alien beings outside or whatever. Again, it just reminded me of that because The Mist is, like, the same sort of movie where everybody's trapped in a building. In that movie, it's a grocery store. And you see how people respond to fear and how people become irrational. And in that one scene, she's, like, super annoying. You know what I mean? Like,
That character's horrible. Yeah. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Yeah. You're talking about Julie in this film. Yeah, I mean, it's,
yes,
like,
both.
She almost has a point in the sense that, like, we don't know who this guy is, and because he never speaks, you know, we just know that this gang is really upset with him for something. So could he possibly be involved in crime himself? Like, we never know. And Bishop, like you said, just has this sixth sense about people. I mean, he knows the good guys from the bad guys, and, you know, it doesn't matter, right? Like, right. Everyone's safety is important to him, and, you know, he goes out of his way to save the lives of criminals in this movie. However, I think we get a sense that he knows that this guy is, you know, whatever he's there for, he didn't really do anything wrong.
Yep, that's right. Anyway, I don't know why I thought of that random scene, but I was kind of just hovering over Julie's character here and thinking, what does she really do in this movie? And that's the only, like, standout scene I can think of, other than, you know, obviously, she was friends with Lori to some capacity, but ends up dead anyhow, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, well, I mean, she's there to die so that Lee, played by Lori, can feel bad about it, can feel like she should have done more. I mean, she expresses that sentiment in one scene, and it is kind of a touching scene about halfway through, where if I had acted a little bit faster, she wouldn't be dead right now. But yeah, she's basically there to just throw this innocent, well, relatively innocent guy under the bus.
To piggyback off what you were saying about the potato game, Wells is able to make it out of the building, gets into the car, and doesn't make it. There's a gang guy, like, in the back of the car just waiting there for him. And that's kind of a sad scene because it just sucks because I feel like even the first time I saw this movie, like, there was a certain feeling of dread that I had that he wasn't going to make it anyway. And I do kind of like that character. Like, Wells is probably a character that I actually do feel a little bit of sadness for when he gets killed. And of course the young girl, Kathy, but,
yeah, I mean, Wells is definitely a sympathetic character, and the way that scene is set up, I like the way it's done because he actually gets a little ways in the car before we know that he's going to die. Like, doesn't he get almost all the way across the parking lot? Which is not far, but it's better than we thought he was going to do.
Yeah, and these guys have, like, a roadblock set up or something, and we don't really see much happen, but we more hear what happens.
Yeah, and, well, we get it from the other character's perspective, which is an interesting choice also.
Right. Bishop's trying to be all optimistic. He's like, I think he made it. And then he's like, yes. Like, probably, you know, totally didn't happen.
Not in the brutal world of Assault in Precinct 13.
Yeah. So where do we go from here? Like, into the finale of this movie where basically this is where I think the Night of the Living Dead influence really comes in. I mean, we have this gang just, like, storming into this building, and their plan is to essentially blow up a bunch of propane, right? Is that what it is? Are they tanks of gas or propane? What is
They've got tanks of gas and they've got flares. So the idea is Bishop has to hit the flares, which will ignite the gas and create an explosion. And they're going to hide behind this sign that they find in a corridor in the basement. Like it, just like any good Western, right? These characters make their last stand in the basement. And that's, I mean, it's not a great plan. And I think even they know it's not a great plan. Just like the thing with the car in the parking lot, that it's basically a suicide mission, and hey, maybe there's a chance we'll survive this. If any of those gang members brought a gun to that final showdown, I think they would have been in a lot of trouble there, but for some reason they completely abandon the guns by this point, and they go to just hand-to-hand fighting, and this horde just breaks in, and it's a wall of gang members that are pushing them back and pushing them back. And of course, you know, it's the rule of threes, right? And Carpenter sets this up and edits this really well, where he takes one shot and he misses, and Napoleon's like, come on, man, you got to do this thing. And he takes another shot and he misses. And then it's like, now we're really in trouble. And they're just pushing back and pushing back, and they continue to encroach. And then finally, of course, on that third shot, he hits it. And those guys get incinerated. The good guys do not. Somehow, I guess hiding behind that sign is, it must be really, really fireproof. And, you know, then those two guys and Lee walk off into the sunset, as it were, together. And we get that sort of classic Western ending. And, you know, again, like, we don't know what's going to happen now. Like, Napoleon is still a criminal no matter what happens. He's probably still headed to death row. But there's this nice little moment between the two of them. It's like, it would be an honor to walk out together with you. So, like, you know, we are on the same level. We are equals now. Even if you're a bad guy and I'm a good guy, we both just did a really good thing.
Yeah, I think at one point one of the police officers actually tries to put cuffs on him, and Bishop's not having it. You know what I mean? He's like, leave him alone or something like that, because obviously, I guess it was the massive explosions that signaled the rest of the police to show up there, because not all of the gang gets incinerated. We see a bunch of them running away at the end as well when the police arrive. But yeah, it's just this like explosive ending where, and it's kind of an abrupt ending too. You know, we get this movie's a tight hour and 30 minutes long.
Well, like I was saying before, like the big action scene in this movie kind of comes in the middle. And, you know, usually the movie will save the best for last and you'll have this explosive action climax. And you kind of have that here. But I think that's a much more subdued and much more it's a much quicker scene than the siege scene in the middle of the movie, where that's the real big action set piece, like I said, of this movie. And this is, you know, I don't want to call it an afterthought, but it is like there's not much to it. You know, you do get that nice moment, like I was saying, where he misses the first two shots and there's a lot of suspense there. But as far as like, you know, what you're going to remember about this movie when you're walking away from it, I think it's that siege sequence that really is the one that's going to stick in your head, and not this kind of, you know, somewhat half-hearted climax that it has. And I agree, it is a little bit abrupt. You know, it doesn't come out of nowhere. I think it's set up well, but I think we're just expecting more out of it. You know, like if this is going to be the climax of this movie that's already shown us what it can do, it's already shown us how action packed it can get. This is a little bit of a letdown compared to that, maybe.
Here's what I like about this movie. Again, I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I think Austin Stoker and Darwin Jostin do fantastic jobs with their characters in this movie. I think the acting overall is pretty good. Tony Burton as well is great. Even the characters that have the shorter parts, like, you know, Charles Cyphers, who we're going to get a lot more of as Starker, I like his character in this movie. I like the whole idea of, like, the unlikely pairing of, you know, this, like, kind of straight-edge police officer having to join forces with, like, these criminals against this like group of savages or something, you know, like that's kind of, it's kind of like the two complete opposite people, as I think you actually mentioned that at the beginning of the show too, have to unite against these forces of belligerent savagery, I guess I would call it.
Yeah, and I think that's a compelling plot just in and of itself. I mean, just the buddy movie aspect of this, I think, works really well, and we are sympathetic to both of those characters. We really like both of those characters, and... You know, the just that sort of siege scenario, the enclosed location, and this unstoppable force, almost like you can kill so many of these guys and still they just keep coming and coming and coming. Like, that's just such a compelling thing to hang a movie on, I feel like.
Yeah, and we got to give a shout out to Tommy Lee Wallace, who did the art direction on this, because, again, he's going to be a frequent collaborator with Carpenter. I think he did art direction. Or maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, he's a production designer, art director. I think he, as far as, you know, a lot of the technical elements in this movie, although these are young filmmakers, although they're kind of inexperienced, I think a lot of stuff just looks really good and feels really good. Like, I believe that this is a real police station, you know what I mean? Like, it is a set.
Sure.
I mean, it was built on a soundstage, but it's constructed in such a way where it is believable. I always kind of wondered... I remember thinking the first time I saw this movie, like, why don't they hide out, like, in some other place in the police station? They actually say that at one point, like, we can't go upstairs because that's all open, so we'd be sitting ducks up there. So they even sort of account for that. One thing that I thought was really fascinating is that the police station set, the exterior where we see the cop who gets shot, we see him walk out of that door. There's a couple shots with Austin Stoker standing out there when he first arrives there. That's in a completely different location than everything else they shot. So those shots of Los Angeles, where it actually looks like South Central Los Angeles, like, there's a shot, reverse shot of the front of the police station and then across the street from the police station. And that across the street was like somewhere else. And the police station was somewhere else than what we see across the street there, but it's cut together so carefully that it never feels like that, right? Like, it is pretty seamless. You know, he's looking out and we get what he's looking at, and we just assume like that parking lot is right across from this police station, when really I believe that was just a couple of towns over in a more sort of wealthy neighborhood than this film is supposed to take place in. So, you know,
that's a very interesting point.
There's a lot of care and sort of talent put into this. John Carpenter has said that this is the first movie he shot on a schedule, because as we talked about with Dark Star, that was a movie where, you know, they just shot when they could. They shot when they had the money to shoot. They shot when they got the actors together. And this one, he actually had to like put in full like 14-hour days. I mean, it is punishing work on a movie set when you spend a whole day there. And, and there's a lot of action in this movie. So it's not like they were just sort of sitting around. Like, this isn't an Eric Rohmer film or something, or a Kevin Smith film. Like, you know, there was makeup and effects and gunshots and squibs and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, you just reminded me when you mentioned the 14-hour shifts. There's a moment during the director commentary where he mentions the longest shoot of his career inside the jail where the actual prison cells are, where they shot for 24 hours straight. And he was just talking about like how fatigued everybody was, but at one point they shot for one day straight.
I mean, I can imagine, but there's just a desperation and sort of a claustrophobia to those scenes that work so well. Like, those are some of my favorite parts of the movie, where they're breaking in through that basement area where the cells are. And like we said, Napoleon breaks the guy's arm, and there's so little room to move in there. And the fights are just so up close and gritty and personal. And I think all that stuff works really well. And yeah, if these guys are sweaty and exhausted and just kind of beat after a day of shooting, like, you can almost feel that in those scenes. And I think that really adds to the effect of everything.
Yeah, and the other thing that I have to say, while we have this conversation, that another thing that I love about this movie is absolutely the score. I remember reading somewhere that he scored, that John Carpenter and I believe Tommy Lee had a hand in the score as well for this. Were able to write it in some ridiculous thing, like 2 or 3 days or something like that. And what I would just like to point out here is that at this point in time, you know, we're talking about really old technology, and just like getting good sounds in general out of a synthesizer is not like an easy thing to do. And I had read somewhere that the main title theme for this was inspired by Led Zeppelin's Immigrant Song.
Yes.
If you can imagine the riff, if you can imagine Jimmy Page's riff to the Immigrant Song, and then listen to the the main theme to Assault on Precinct 13. It sounds very similar. And that's what we hear like throughout most of the movie is this, you know, dun 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 with the hi-hats and the percussive stuff. But there's also this electric piano theme that plays, and it's very it's used in the more quieter moments of the scene. And I just think the way that it's articulated is really cool. Like, for example, you know, scenes like when Bishop first enters the precinct, and it's just kind of abandoned or whatever, and these electric piano keys come in and play a really just kind of, I don't know, I just love that melody that's played on there. But aside from that, those are basically the two main pieces of music that we get in this movie, but for some reason, the score just works so effectively.
Yeah, I mean, it's gritty and minimalist like a lot of the rest of the movie is, and I think it definitely does what it needs to. And I've read about Carpenter saying it's inspired by Immigrant Song, and it took me a lot of listens before I could sort of hear the connection there, and now I can't sort of unhear it. But I do, I mean, it is this sort of very intense, again, pulsating synth score like he did with Dark Star. And, you know, it becomes kind of like the gang's theme music almost. It's like a Peter and the Wolf thing. Like, you know, they're coming because you hear this sort of repeated like synth phrase, and that signifies them.
Yeah. And for you listeners out there, if anybody finds this soundtrack on vinyl at a reasonable price, please let me know.
Don't have this one.
This one is very difficult to find. It was never really available until it was reissued in like 2003. And there are several reissues of this, of Assault on Precinct 13 on vinyl. And usually when they come out, they're pressed in limited quantity and they sell out like right away. And then people sell them used for, you know, pretty high prices. Yeah, I'm looking for this one, or just waiting for a new reissue to come out. But this is one that definitely people want to have in their vinyl collection.
I could definitely see myself driving around listening to that theme and feeling like a real badass doing that. Can I read to you a sentence that I wrote? So I saw this film for the first time in about 15 years and was just trying to get my thoughts down on paper. And I came up with this thing, and I hate it because it sounds like the start of a pretentious New York Times review of movies. And I think it's correct in some sense, but I also like, I think I'm a real douche for saying stuff like this, but here we go. Tell me what you think.
Bring it.
Assault on Precinct 13 is just as good for what's not in the movie as it is for what is in the movie.
Oh my God. I would just discontinue reading that whole review right there.
Well, let me explain though, because I think the point is valid, and I don't know. It's like I came up with the most pretentious way of saying it. But like what I was saying to you not too long ago before we started recording, I think Assault and Precinct 13 is not a 4-star movie. It's not a perfect movie. It's an entertaining movie and I like it a lot, but it has some flaws, and you know, it's definitely not Carpenter's best. However, what I really like about it is that it's so uncomplicated. Like, these characters never really reveal their backstories. The plot is really, really easy to follow. Like, there's no bullshit in this movie, right? Like, there's nothing here that would distract us from just sort of the central things, which are this friendship between these two characters that develops, and this action about the siege that's happening and all that, right? Like, we don't really know anything about the gang. We don't really know anything about, like, what any of these characters are doing. Like, all the stuff that movies do to sort of distract us and make us, you know, take our minds in other directions and make us think about things that we probably shouldn't be thinking about when we should be focusing on the action of the movie. There is none of that here, right? Like, it's just, it's so stark and it's so, I mean, the word I guess I would use is visceral, right? Like, this is just a gut level kind of movie. You don't need to be sort of figuring out the plot every 30 seconds, you know? You don't need to be questioning these complicated character motivations. You don't have to really question the morality of a character like Napoleon. Like, you know, he's a bad guy. And you know, he sort of has a history, but we never find out what that history is. So it's just like the adrenaline and the emotion, like there's nothing to get in the way of it. And, you know, I think maybe part of that is just because Carpenter's so young at this point. He's inexperienced. He's not a seasoned writer where he's filling out these sort of very elaborate character backstories and all these like plot mechanics and stuff like that. And, you know, it's just like my favorite people in the world are people who are straight shooters who just like tell me what they need to tell me and they don't beat around the bush and they don't bullshit around at all. And I feel like this movie is very much like that. Like, here is what this is and here is what you're supposed to appreciate about it. And you know, it's just like I use the word minimalist, and I kind of feel like in some ways it is. Like, there's not a whole other world that's suggested by Assault on Precinct 13. Like, it really does sort of zero in on these characters, this situation, their relationships, and it just sort of plays out in the moment, and you don't really have to think about it much afterward. And I don't know, I just really appreciate that about it. Is that crazy? I mean, am I wrong about that? Or just the way I said it is bad?
I think the opening sentence is hilarious, but I think, like, as you fleshed out your point, yeah, I absolutely get that. And I think, like, the characters in this are likable enough where it's worth watching a couple times. It does have, like, some replay value to it. And once you get familiar with it, like, it's fun to see Napoleon and Bishop, you know, go on this, get involved in this insanely dangerous situation. But I love it,
and,
man.
And they don't talk much, right? I mean, that's another thing I like about it. Like, even the script is minimalist, where there's there's dialogue here, but, you know, no one has, like, a long monologue about, like, you know, in these kinds of movies, like, even, like, a Night of the Living Dead kind of thing, there's always that quiet moment where the characters are just sitting around and somebody, like, unfurls this, like, 2-minute-long monologue about where they came from and what their mother was like and some formative experience that they had. And, you know, the closest this movie gets to that is when Bishop just says, yeah, you know, I've been to this police station before, my dad sent me down here with a note and all that. And, you know, it's just a little thing that shows you how he basically earned his respect for the law as a little kid, but it's just sort of over and done with in 30 seconds, and then we can move on with the important stuff.
That's totally where Tarantino got the idea for the briefcase in Pulp Fiction, right? it's another stretch.
What,
but
you mean the case with the loaded gun in it? Because that makes no sense at all. Right? Like, let me very meticulously load some shells into this shotgun and then put it in a locked case. Like, what's the point? Like, either don't load it or, I don't know, don't lock the case or don't put it in a case.
Yeah, they had to, like, show that for it to make sense later on, but you're right, it is a very stupid thing to do in the first place. No, I was thinking about, like, Bishop's character points to something that he carved on the desk when he was a kid or something.
Oh, yes, yeah, I'm sorry that we didn't mention that. I love that. Like, yeah. We never see that, because it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
There's a great movie. I'm going to make a connection that no one has made before. My favorite movie of a couple of years ago was called A Ghost Story. And one of the plot points in that movie is about, like, when you live in a house, you should write a note and only you know what's in that note and, like, hide it in the walls somewhere. So a character does that and we never see what was on the note. And so, like, every viewer can kind of make up, you know, whatever is important to you, then that's what's on there, and it could be anything. And I love, like, we never get even close to a reverse shot of that desk to see what he carved onto the desk, and I love that moment. I mean, it's a little bit film school-ish, but he's just a couple years out of film school, so I think we can appreciate that, and we can let that slide. I like stuff like that.
Well, I just get excited for stuff like this, because now when I pop in, shout out to, God, it's going to sound like really punny, but shout out to Shout Factory and their awesome Steelbook Blu-ray reissue of this movie. It looks fantastic. And I just love when I put it in and the credits come on and it's just the red lettering on the black backdrop and the beat drops. And it's just, it's awesome. You know, like, but I will agree with you. At the end of the day, it's not a 4-star movie. Some of the low budgetry, like, really seeps through. But it's definitely, I'd say, a solid 3-star movie. And again, for this early on in their career and with all of the, again, just the challenges of a low budget aspect, like, I think this is a really well-made film. And
Well, it just shows a lot of things on his part, right? Like, one, that he could just get a project done and you know, work within these budgets. But as far as the choreography of the action scenes and things like that and the character dynamics that we talked about, you know, there was a lot of that in Dark Star. I mean, there's a lot of interesting interplay between the characters in Dark Star, but I think that steps up a level here. The coherence of the story definitely steps up a level here from the earlier film. So it's definitely a step in the right direction. And we can see this style sort of starting to really emerge and these, you know, these ways of doing things emerge. I mean, how many, like, you've seen even more John Carpenter movies than I have, and how many scenes in his films do we have where there's just this like horde of bad guys and some hero that has to mow them all down like as they're coming at him, you know? Like, that's a thing we see over
every
and over
movie
over, pretty much. The other thing, just before we drop this conversation entirely, this movie shows that John Carpenter really likes unconventional heroes, I feel like, because you've got this, Bishop is a pretty straightforward, straight-laced kind of guy, but Napoleon is a criminal, and yet he is the hero, and he's the one we're supposed to really sympathize with, the one that I think we have the most emotional attachment to in this movie, and that just points the way forward to characters like Snake Plissken, for example, or even Dr. Loomis in Halloween. I mean, he's this sort of frail old man who is the hero of the movie and saves the day at the end, and you know, that's not usually who is the victor in a horror movie. That's not the character that we usually see triumph over evil in the end. So, you know, Carpenter, I guess he's got a thing for the underdog. He's got a thing for these sort of characters that you might not see as heroic in most movies. And he likes to sort of create a hero myth about them.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Always supporting the underdog. And that's just something that's like kind of wired into my genetics. So it's something that I appreciate about his movies a lot. And you're absolutely right. It's a common thread. And I mean, off the top of my head, like many, many of his films, the unconventional hero is like a centerpiece of it. So,
yeah. And, you know, like not to take this thread too far, but you can sort of see a little bit of that mentality in Carpenter himself, you know, the way he struggles with the studios over the years and has this really uncompromising vision. And, you know, he's a guy who really has no problem mixing genres. Like, there's going to be comedy in this sci-fi movie, and there's going to be sci-fi and action and Western tropes mixed into this movie together. So, you know, his movies sometimes defy real easy classification, and he just doesn't care. I mean, he's really uncompromising about that and is just out to sort of put these genre mashups on the screen.
I'm sorry, I was going to add into your rant there. And then he makes a movie with Chevy Chase where he's invisible.
Yeah, we'll get to that one. I'll be honest, I mean, of all the films that we're going to talk about over the course of the show, I saw that one when I was a kid, and I've heard I think I actually liked it when I was a kid because I didn't know any better, and it was like a grown-up movie, so it's like, okay, yeah, I could probably enjoy that, but I have a feeling that one's going to be really painful, and therefore, I'm just really pumped to see it again. Like, I may have to watch Memoirs of an Invisible Man before, like, long before we actually get to it on the show. I may just have to satisfy my morbid curiosity about it. But any final thoughts on Precinct 13? I mean, we've gone pretty far on this one, and I think this is a film that deserves it. I almost thought we should do two episodes on Precinct 13, but we'll save the double episode treatment, I think, for the next film in the filmography, which we'll talk about in just a second. But anything else to say about this one before we head out?
I really like this movie. I'm glad we finally got to talk about it. That's all I got to say, man. I know it had been a while for you. And that is the one other thing I'll say, is that there is a remake of this movie from 2005 with Larry Fishburne and Ethan Hawke. I have not seen it. Nick, you have. another thing that I think we should cover at some point in our wheelhouse of bonus episodes, along with things like The Eyes of Laura Mars and things of that nature. But we're not going to be covering the reboot at this point in time because, for timing's sake, and for the purpose of doing this in order chronologically, our next movie is going to be on 1978's Halloween.
Yes, and it will be absolutely the perfect season to talk about that. We are just getting into October now, so what better time of the year to talk about what I think is sort of, you know, there's a lot of Halloween movies out there. There's a lot of movies that celebrate the spirit of the season, but I don't think there is a movie that does it quite as well as Carpenter's prototypical slasher classic Halloween. So we will be talking about that really soon.
Yep. Perfect.
So if you have enjoyed our discussion of Assault on Precinct 13, or if you have any comments or questions or any kind of feedback you want to give us, you can drop us a line at precinct13podcast@gmail.com. We are on Twitter at 13precinct, facebook.com/13precinct, and our website is precinct13.simplecast.com. That's where you can find all of our episodes. You can also find subscription links for iTunes or your favorite podcast service there. Like I said, we would love to know how we're doing. So drop us a line, send us a comment, give us a rating, give us a review. We just want to keep making this show better and better, like John Carpenter's movies get for a while, and then other stuff happens later on. But for the moment, we want to be on that sort of upward trajectory that his film career was on in the 70s and early 80s. So what do you think, Chris? Should we head on out of here?
I think we shall.
All right, good. I've got my Street Thunder initiation happening later tonight, so I hope to see you there.
Oh,
it should be a whole lot of fun. So
me, nothing but a bunch of bloodletting. That's all.
Yeah, I don't like the sight of my own blood because it looks nothing like 70s movie blood, but we'll do what we can. All right, so with that, I have been Nick, he has been Chris, and we will talk to you real soon.